back on camera, and I was just explaining that as we deal with issues like this and the unknowns that lie ahead in 2009, we could make two mistakes. We could dismiss it and, like Pollyanna, just assume it will self-correct, and it may, and we hope so. But that could beg the question of mechanical elements like the new administration wanting to inject $1 trillion worth of money into the economy, wanting it to move very rapidly to get the problem solved. Then you have a large supply of money, high velocity, and keeping inflation under control under those circumstances would be tough. Let me ask a question here. I'm just interested in feedback from an obviously well-read audience. The last time we had hyperinflation and government tried to do something about it was back when? Well, you're going back to Jimmy Carter. I'm thinking going back a little bit earlier to Richard M. Nixon. Remember his wage and price controls that he put in? And there were huge volumes of books that attorneys and accountants that were working in this field had to master very quickly. Nixon tried to control wages and prices by government fiat. It didn't work. Why? Because the private market forces are also at work competing with it. If you have an underground economy that goes off the record, you can have real inflation soaring, and the government has no way to check on what the real prices are in many instances. What is the perfect governmental control over an underground economy? It's this thing, a national identity card. What I'm holding here is prototypical. I got this several years ago from a gentleman who worked for the company that makes these smart cards. They're more and more in circulation now. We use them a lot. Government could easily do that. And if we issued smart cards and required this to be your access to the cash register, then every transaction, purchase or sale, can be monitored by those big computers in Baltimore. Therefore, we can spot the outliers. We can prosecute those who are busting the wage price control limits. Hyperinflation would be one of the quickest ways to probably see government want to go to some system like this, where a person becomes a card, your identity lives in this card, and this is your access to commerce. Now, is there anything inherently wrong with this technology? No. The technology is not vulgar. What makes it bad is the misuse that this kind of technology could be put to. Now, what troubles us is that Revelation 13 predicts it will happen and it will be misused. Okay? So what's happening up here is not academic. It's a very real part of people who are concerned about end time issues. And my plea is that we approach this thing in a measured, rational way. I could give you opinions and data this afternoon that would leave us, all of us, leaving this building with permanent white knuckles. It could be that tough. Why do that? Because I can't read the future and I could be wrong. So let's look at it from a rational, balanced perspective, recognizing what could happen, recognizing what might happen, recognizing what we hope happens. And if heaven intervenes, as heaven has intervened before, this thing could blow over. But if it does, heaven help us, because we're going to be on this world a lot longer, because God's people are going to go right back to sleep. All right, let's talk about the economy. Implications for an end-time people. We've looked at the economic crisis currently faced by America and the world. Now, what implications does that have for end-time believers? Let me start with a quote. This is one I'm sure should be familiar to you. Volume 9, page 11. The agencies of evil are combining their forces and consolidating. They're strengthening for the last great crisis. Great changes are soon to take place in our world. And the final movements will be rapid ones. Now, let's reflect on the events we've just lived through. Just a few weeks ago, the federal government swallowed two mortgage giants, and in the process of doing that, theoretically at least, dumped $5 trillion onto the backs of U.S. taxpayers, instantly doubling the U.S. debt. Now, you think about that. Last July, we never dreamed it could be this bad. Last April, they were still predicting economic growth. Now, let's talk about implications for us. Number one, let's recognize the forces at work. As we have seen, massive forces were at work in the 1990s and early part of the 21st century in the economic world. Most of these were only dimly sensed or understood. As late as April of 08, they weren't understood by renowned economists. Back when home values were soaring and it was not that hard to get rich, it was easy to dismiss Ellen White's end-time warnings as an anachronism that progressive Adventism needed to mature out of. I mean, like Sunday laws? Hardy, har, 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 give me a break. Sunday laws, the malls are open on Sunday and we go to football games. How's a Sunday law ever going to happen? Well, you get another 9/11 or a roaring depression and you're going to see people rediscovering Sunday. Well, we could say the 19th century has little to say to the 21st, but wait a second. Other forces, clearly predicted by Ellen White, were also at work in subtle ways that progressive thinkers might fail to recognize. By the way, what does the term progressive mean? We throw this term around all the time. I finally went to Webster's and discovered that it means a steady progress toward a stated goal. Well, that's what Adventism's all about, isn't it? Steady progress toward the stated goal of heaven. Anyway, it's a little bit dangerous to get too skeptical of a prophet because we haven't seen the future. And if the prophet is what he or she claims to be, they have. And without that advantage, we just might miss something. As, for example, Ellen White's interesting prediction and commentary about labor unions. Now, were labor unions the product of abuse? You bet they were. The robber barons of the 19th century abused laborers, and Ellen White screamed in defiance against this and said it is absolutely wrong and the time will come when they will pay a very severe price. So the abuse of the laboring classes in this country was a wrong, just as was slavery. And by the way, all of the pioneers of Adventism were ardent abolitionists. Are you aware of that? Ardent abolitionists. By the way, to those here for whom it means a lot, happy MLK Day next Monday, okay? I was a young broadcast reporter back when the events were taking place in Selma and Birmingham and so forth. I have it burned into my psyche the institutional memory of what it took to rescue America from a lot of wrong. That's wrong, not because I don't happen to be African American. That's just wrong because it's morally wrong. It's repulsive to a constitution that I respect and revere. So anyway, back in those days, Ellen White said, trade unions will be one of the agencies that will bring upon this earth a time of trouble such as has not been since the world began. You want to look that up? You'll find it in the little booklet, Country Living, page 10. It's a manuscript release, letter 200, 1903. So she predicts that trade unions will bring the world to a position where it's in a time of trouble such as has never been seen on planet Earth. Now, wait a second. Trade unions? Reagan busted them, didn't he? They haven't been a factor since 1980. Or did he? See, to predict Ellen White's, or to accept, I should say, Ellen White's prediction about trade unions required simply an awful lot of faith. You really had to have faith in what she said. And a lot of people put their jobs on the line simply because they did have faith. Well, for years, I didn't know why she said it. I just assumed she meant, you know, physical strife in the streets between management and labor. I couldn't see beyond that because I was looking at it from my current database. Sunday laws, trade unions, malls are open on Sunday. How can this ever happen? And then notice something. Trade unions began a subtle tectonic shift in the whole economic structure of the world. Let me explain how it happened. Right after World War II, we began to see a subtle shift in U.S. industry. It was hard to see it at first. Really, as I look back, it first happened in the merchant shipping industry. My uncle was a merchant marine officer during World War II and after the war, and he continued serving as a vessel captain and then as a radio operator in merchant ships. But little by little, his sources of income dried up. He was a member of the Maritime Union. He would go to the hiring hall and would take a while before they could even find a ship to put him on because there weren't that many ships anymore. What was happening? The wage scales of union workers in the American shipping industry rose so high that shipping companies finally just threw their hands up and said, we can't make money doing this, or we can't make as much money as we would like. So what'd they do? They went offshore to two countries, Liberia in Africa and Panama in the Western Hemisphere. These were friendly countries. They flagged their ships there. And you would see down at L.A. Harbor ship after ship, below the name was Monrovia, Liberia, and the Liberian flag flying on the stern, because there unions could not intrude and wage scales were dramatically reduced. So ships that once sailed under the U.S. flag now appeared under Nigerian and Panamanian flags, and almost overnight, the U.S. shipping industry all but disappeared. It was kind of a harbinger of things to come. And this was, interestingly enough, occurring just as the Soviets, flushed with the wealth that we provided in Lend-Lease during World War II, began building some of the finest merchant ships in the world. I well remember when I was on active duty, particularly the summer I spent down off of Guantanamo Bay patrolling there, we would watch ship after ship come by with the red banner and the yellow hammer and sickle on the funnel. Some of the most beautiful merchant ships in the world were now Soviet. Well, the process didn't end there. The shipping industry began to drift out of American life. Pretty soon the steel industry began moving offshore, and then importation of small cars, ultimately followed by larger cars of stunning quality. And at the same time, Detroit was building stuff you didn't want to buy. I well remember the story. I heard it from an auto dealer. Said, we had a customer, kept coming in. There was a rattle in the dash. Couldn't figure out what it was. Finally pulled the whole dash out. Cost him much of the profits on the sale of the car, and inside there, in one of the heater ducts, was a beer can with a note taped onto it, congratulations, you found it. Now, that was the work ethic of American car builders back when we were competing with Japanese workers who, before they went to work in the morning, went outside, did calisthenics, lined up, and sang the company song. Do you see a little problem there? We have very skilled, very, very ambitious people in other parts of this world, very ready to take our place if we miss a stroke, and very capable of doing it. So the auto industry began to disappear. And then technical goods like computers. You know, we invented the computer. You know why we did? We couldn't do enough calculations to really produce an atomic weapon. It just required the use of too many digits. So we created this monster. It filled a building the size of a two-bedroom house. It was called ENIAC. It consumed enough electricity to basically run a small city. And it was nothing compared to now to what we wear on our watches or carry on our cell phones. But that's why we built the thing. We had to do computations sufficiently sophisticated to build a nuclear weapon. Well, we invented the computer, but our very skilled and competent and ambitious competition overseas quickly got into the problem, into the process of producing them. Then household appliances. Ultimately, nearly everything we used to make, sewing machines, table lamps, toys, some of them laced with lead, and for that matter, services we used to provide, like calling and getting Sam on the phone when we're asking about our utility bill, get shipped overseas. In other words, labor issues and the artificially high standard of living that we enjoy in this country have resulted in the migration of U.S. manufacture and service industry and business offshore, except for a few major items like autos, and we're about to lose them. A complete restructuring of the world economy. Now, how did Ellen White describe it? A time of trouble such has not been since the world began. See, Revelation 13 describes a lamb, beautiful animal, two horns, civil and religious liberty, in an uninhabited part of the earth with so much wealth waiting to be picked up, there's wealth enough there to quickly finish the work of God when right there in that same place the work of God is discovered and begins to be promoted. I'm convinced that basically the Lord intended for Adventism to be the revolution that Marxism later tried to imitate. We were to go out and take the world by storm. This was not supposed to be siege warfare lasting over a century and a half. We were supposed to do it in a very few years, and back then we could have. Have you seen the population curve of the world in the last few years? Back then it was a lot smaller world in terms of population, and the Advent message was preached all over the world. Asia, the South Pacific Islands, believe it or not, Europe, South America, North America. The work could have been done in times where technology did not exist, but willing hearts did. And think of the pioneers of this church. Go out in sleighs in the kind of cold that we're hearing about on the TV now. Didn't stop them. They went out in sleighs and went hundreds of miles to simply visit a few believers and try to spread the truth. We're still coasting in this church on the energy of those pioneers. Pioneers like John Burden couldn't afford Loma Linda, but it was enough that Ellen White said, buy it at any cost. He went in debt for it himself, personally. My dad heard him speak. And he said the Holy Spirit was so powerfully in the room when John Burden preached, you either gave in or you got out. So here we have this progression of events in which God has designed a revolution that was supposed to happen quickly, and we bogged down in this world because we just can't fall out of love with it. Ellen White describes a complete restructuring of the world economy, such a time of trouble as has not been since the world began. That's more than just management and labor fighting in the streets over whether you organize a local union. That has implications of global importance. Before we write off the current economic trouble as just a bump in the road, we better stop to think how massively the world is changing. America is rapidly losing its industrial base. It's rapidly losing its economic leverage, except perhaps for the fear of creditor nations worried that we'll go bankrupt. We're rapidly becoming dependent on foreign sources, not only of manufactured goods, but of the money to buy them. Worse, there are dangerous forces at work dedicated to bringing America down. You're aware, I hope, that Osama bin Laden, after 9/11, promulgated as one of the primary goals of his attack on the West to destroy the American economy. Why? Because a nation's economy reflects directly on its ability to make war. Now, I'm totally convinced that Revelation 13 correctly says America will speak as a dragon. There will be economic controls at the end of time. But what turns a lamb into a dragon? How does a lamb become a dragon? Gets pushed into a corner, doesn't it? Then it gets fierce. As Russia proved, you no longer have to be wealthy to possess hideously dangerous weapons, and a frightened lamb may suddenly emerge as a dragon. And the conclusion is that this may not be the end, but the ingredients for the end of the world are all assembling steadily on the stage of history, many of them buried out of notice, as, for example, this subtle shift through labor unions of the world economy, until suddenly, as happened last September, they just burst into notice like something emerging out of the bottom of the sea, and were shocked to see it suddenly happen. They burst into the view of a surprised and frightened world. Well, should we have been surprised? Let me read something from Maranatha, which you hopefully are familiar with, but I think it's worth rereading. Maranatha 138. Transgression has almost reached its limits. Confusion fills the world, and a great terror is soon to come upon human beings. The end is very near. We who know the truth should be preparing for what is soon to break upon the world as an overwhelming surprise. Review, point number one, powerful forces are at work, leading us directly to an end time world. Where it goes from here is up to heaven. It isn't up to me, and I wouldn't try to necessarily guess the next move. Point number two, it was never God's intent we get here. You know that? It was never the Lord's intent that we still find ourselves in this world in 2009. Back in 1883, Ellen White wrote this: had Adventists, after the great disappointment, held fast their faith, Christ would have come ere this. 1883. We were never designed to be here this long. 7 years later, she said it all again, page 449 of volume 6. Had the purpose of God been carried out by his people in giving to the world a message of mercy, Christ would ere this have come and the saints would have received their welcome into the city of God. 8 more years went by. Ellen White was now in Australia helping to establish Avondale College. She reiterated her mournful reference to what might have been, and then she added a litany of reasons why the Advent dream was still unfulfilled. And let me read it to you. If God's people had the love of Christ in the heart, if every church member was thoroughly imbued with the spirit of self-sacrifice, there would be no lack of funds. 1,000 doors of usefulness would be open. Christ would have come to earth ere this. That in 1898. And in 1901, she repeated it in almost identical language, although now something ominous is creeping into her prediction. There just may be a horrific delay. Evangelism, page 696. We may have to remain here in this world because of insubordination many more years, as did Israel. But for Christ's sake, his people should not add sin to sin by charging God with the consequences of their own course of action. Never was his intention that we be here this long. Then along comes 2001, September day. And if anything should have waked up the church, that should have. But here we are. And then on an autumn day in 2008, we face a crisis we may not be able to shuck off as easily or cavalierly as we did 2001. Maybe the economy is the only way heaven can awaken a sleeping people. Maybe the forces are here at last that can catalyze and accelerate the second coming. And for that, I just want to suggest we don't look at world events with fear or dismay. They're just signposts on the way home. Thanks for the privilege of being with you. I think I'll take my cold and my increasingly non-cooperative voice back to where I can get some good hot water. Thanks.